Wonderful baby, living on love. The Sandman says maybe he'll take you above. Up where the girls fly on ribbons and bows, where babies float by, just counting their toes. Wonderful baby, nothing but new. The world has gone crazy, I'm glad I'm not you. At the beginning, or is it the end? It goes in and comes out and starts over again.
All right, and our guest is Kent Heckenlively. Did you hear that? Wonderful baby. The world has gone crazy. I'm glad I'm not you. Well, you know, these babies are now being born into a world. And the reason I played that, we did start the program by talking about the murder of babies. But now we have babies that are hated because of the color of their skin. We're told that babies are racist. Six-month-old babies are racist. Where is this coming from? Well, it's coming from the diversity, inclusivity, and equity. I like to mention them in those three orders because it spells D-I-E, die. I think that's what we're headed for. But Kent Heckenlively is an attorney and a science teacher, also a New York Times bestselling author. And he's put together a book talking about the whistleblower experiences for a guy who's whistleblower for Project Veritas and exposing a lot of this, they call it DEI training. I call it D-I-E training. So joining us now is Kent Heckenlively. Thank you for joining us, Kent.
Thanks so much for having me, David. Yeah, the book is The Diversity Con.
Yes.
It just published last Tuesday. My publisher always demands that I must show the book on every interview. So now,
well, that's good. You can put it up there at any point in time. That's good. The Diversity Con, and yeah, hold it up at any time you want to. That's fine. We're fine with that. It looks like a very interesting book. And tell us a little bit about how this came together.
Well, this is my fourth book with a Project Veritas whistleblower. So I've done the Google whistleblower, I've done the Facebook whistleblower, I've done the CNN whistleblower, and now I'm doing the DEI, or I actually like that, D-I-E. I think that's probably a better formulation. Yeah. But my co-author, David Johnson, is an extraordinary young man, 26 years old, black, and kind of left of center, actually, and he's gay. Mm-hmm. And what happened was he is a packaging engineer, and he got a job at Hasbro, the toy giant. And within the first couple weeks that he was there, they had him do this DEI training, and he had the foresight to push the record button on it. And he heard this crazy thing that, you know, babies as young as 6 months old are displaying racial preferences. At 2 years old, they're excluding people. And he thought this was just crazy. And so his experience as a black gay man in America, the America that was depicted in this video was not the one that he had experienced in his life. Mm-hmm. And as I said, he kind of considered himself a little bit left of center. He jokingly says, you know, he wants to be able to go to a gay wedding with a gun in his pocket and some pot on somebody's land who has their own nuclear generator. That's sort of his libertarian perspective. And so, you know, he appeared on Project Veritas, and that was a huge story. But what he really wanted to do is he wanted to go deeper into it. And so with the great staff at Bombardier Press, we came up with a plan that he would go undercover at a number of DEI classes so that we could document what was going on. And then we did a deeper investigation as to who's funding this craziness and why might they be funding it. So I think that the book is a great combination of, you know, the humorous stuff that's going on, that, you know, mm-hmm. it's really mm-hmm. craziness being taught in these classes. So, you know, there's a lot of humor in this stuff that, you know, even though it's very serious, you know, I always try to take, you know, the satirical approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we also need to understand what the system is and who the people are behind these civil rights organizations. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't even call them civil rights organizations. I call them civil disorder organizations.
Yes.
And so I think that that's a really interesting combination. The other thing that I just want to mention to your listeners is Dennis Prager has been a longtime supporter of the books that I've written, and he wrote just a wonderful foreword for the book. So for those of you who listen to Dennis Prager, this is something that he is just 100% behind.
Well, that's and of course, Hasbro, a kid's toy place, so you can imagine what they're going to be doing in terms of their marketing of kids' toys. But we've seen this, whether it's Coca-Cola or whether it's NASCAR, and it's especially, with something like NASCAR, they want to go head-to-head with their conservative audience. They're not trying to market, what people want anymore. They've got an agenda that they're pushing. And talk a little bit about this. I mean, when they talk about these terms, diversity, equity, inclusion, all this type of stuff, anti-racism, what is it? Pick any of these terms and tell us what they really mean about it. Because, they pick words that sound great to us, right? And they carefully choose these terms, just like they talk about equity and people think, oh, equality. What do they mean by these terms?
It's a great question. And I think that's what motivated me in putting this book together, because one of the things that just got to David was the training told them that they should consider ways of pushing a social justice message through the toys, mm-hmm. without the knowledge of the parents. And he's thinking to himself, well, geez, he's supposed to consider himself as an oppressed minority. And, his lived experience in America is that what the heck does my race or my sexual orientation have to do with me packaging a toy so that it doesn't break in transit? Okay. What is the efficiency of the packaging? Yeah. What does my sexuality or my race have to do with the efficiency of the packaging?
That's right.
Nothing.
That's right.
And so, the question is, why is this stuff being pushed? And I think it's got a couple moving parts. Part one is that a lot of these social justice organizations are Marxist in orientation, mm-hmm. and they will tell you specifically that they are. For example, we do a large profile on Black Lives Matter, and we look at not only their philosophy and the philosophy of DEI, which is Marxist in orientation. It's got, targets, agents and oppressors, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's typical Marxist philosophy. However, that doesn't answer the question as to why some of the wealthiest corporations in America are funding this crap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it makes no sense. So do we really believe that left-wing billionaires are funding Marxism because they want to bring in Marxism? No, that makes more sense. No sense. What makes more sense, and what we profile, is how these wealthy corporations are funding these social justice warriors who are in turn destroying local communities so that then Target, Amazon, name your large organization. Suddenly, with local communities destroyed, everybody's buying things online.
Yep.
Well, who's in the online world? It's these left-wing billionaires like Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, take your pick, Jeff Bezos. And so what we're seeing is that it's not Marxism that they're trying to bring about, but a monopoly,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to get us hooked on these other systems is to not have us interact with people in our community. So let's destroy the family. Let's destroy the community. And what's left? We're human beings. We have to connect to something. We connect to the government, and we connect to big business.
That's right. Absolutely. And that's exactly what we saw with what was happening in 2020 with the lockdowns. Main Street is non-essential, we were told. These businesses, if it's a small business, we don't care about that business, and we don't care about your job if you work for them. You need to work for the big guys, and you need to all go into your cubicle that we'll call a house eventually, and you need to buy everything online from us. And you know, we were told that was, you know, that they were essential. And everybody else is non-essential. It is exactly, you're right, it's exactly the same thing that has been pushed by both parties, by all these politicians for the last 3 years. And that's, I think, the real agenda. I agree with you 100%. That is the real agenda. Yeah, these people really do hate our society, but, you know, ultimately, it's all about them getting monopolistic control of everything, because that's really ultimately what it is about the Marxists as well. They'll come up with any kind of lie they can, whether it's about, struggle of the masses, capitalism, all the rest of stuff, or if it's a race war, whatever, anything that they can use in order to get all power and money to themselves. We see that over and over again in these Marxist authoritarian totalitarian regimes, don't we?
Yeah, and it may be something counterintuitive, but the groups that I hope read this book are the social justice organizations, because they're being taken advantage of. Because I genuinely believe that in their hearts, they want to do good by their community. But what they don't understand is how they're being used. Mm-hmm. And the example that we make from history is that the pirates that we think of from the Caribbean didn't start off as lawless entities. They started off as representatives of the British Crown. So the British did not have the navy that they would have in subsequent centuries. So what they gave was a letter of marque to these privateers to go against the Spanish Main. Well, what happened when Britain made peace with Spain? Suddenly they wanted to get rid of the pirates, and some of the pirates didn't go along with it. And so that's when you got the real fight between the British Navy and the pirates. Well, these social justice organizations have to understand that they're pawns. Okay. So, you know, they do some amazing scholarship. They have all these ideas and everything. They're really committed, but they're doing the wrong thing. They're serving the wrong masters. They need to talk to the conservatives who are genuinely interested in every human being succeeding. And they need to understand that they're not bringing in Marxism. They're not bringing in, oh, gee, our community is going to do great. What's happening is they're being used to destroy their own communities for the benefit of these billionaires, who, as soon as these social justice organizations are not needed by the billionaires, they're going to turn against them. Mm-hmm. So these social justice organizations need to consider themselves like the privateers who thought that the British Crown was their friend. The British Crown was not their friend. These billionaires are not the friends of minorities. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to talk about how we achieve success, and I think that's where conservatives really have the edge, because we believe in systems of success, not just goals. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, hey, I want to weigh 30 pounds less. Okay, well, that means I need to have a system that I eat less food. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you can't just wish for something. You have to have a strategy, and that's what conservatives need to say to these people who, you know, are the front for this, because I really think the social justice organizations are missing the big picture. Mm-hmm. We are not their enemies. We want them to succeed. The people they think are their friends are their deadliest enemies.
Yes, that's a good analogy. I like the analogy of the pirates. And if anybody wants more information about that, they can see Pirates of Penzance. Explain. Yeah. We are not pirates. We're single gentlemen, you know. But yeah, I agree. And it is, you know, it's ultimately about power. And you know, corporations will do it for economic power. You have a lot of the people who have done the march through the institutions And this is pervasive. You know, it's not just with the corporations, it's also with our educational institutions. So many institutions have, you know, whether you're talking about entertainment or media or education or the corporations, all these different ones, they've got the people who are leading this understand that they are going to be the ones who are going to be empowered by it. Just as we see Lenin had his useful idiots, these people are the useful idiots of the neo-Marxists who are trying to run this stuff through, and they'll always have a justification to justify the chaos and other things that they implement. You know, Kent, I've played many times a recording from Fauci just before all this stuff kicked off. It was in October 2019. And I love the way that he laid it out. It was very clear. They said, you know, how do we get people to take a shot that hasn't been tested? He goes, well, we do it from the inside. We do it with disruption, and we do it incrementally. And that's the way they always get their agenda through, regardless of what. That's what is happening with the DIE stuff as well, isn't it? They're doing it from the inside. They're using it to create chaos and to destroy our society, and they're doing it incrementally. Tell us a little bit about the whole idea of equity, because this is a key thing that the left has been on for a long time. They're not talking about equality of opportunity. What are they talking about?
One of the really interesting things that David Johnson observed when he went to these DEI training seminars is, like, the first day or so would be all sort of information that, you know, is good to know, and probably the average person would go, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. You know, day two was when things started to get a little bit sketchy and they'd introduce some Marxist ideas. And day three is where they go completely nuts with things. And so, you know, the idea is, you know, we want all people to succeed, okay? But they're leaving out the role of the individual, the role that the things that you do matter for your life. You know, one of the really interesting things that I just heard recently was the different amounts of time that Asian, white, and Black students spend every week doing homework or work outside of school, which supports school. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Asian students average about 13 hours. White students, about 8. Black students, about 5. Okay, think about that. Mm-hmm. So between your average white student and your average Asian student, the Asian student is studying 5 hours more a week. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's what, 45, 50 minutes a day. Mm-hmm. You know, break it down into chunks that can be done. You know, also things like the family. You know, only 17% of Asian kids are living with a single parent. Mm-hmm. 25% of whites, 75% of blacks. Okay? Yeah. If you just look at those kind of numbers, you know, let's make it simplistic. Let's say, what's your strategy for success? Like, if you're going to lose weight, you need to consume fewer calories. Mm-hmm. It's a real simple way of looking at the world. So we don't have to talk about, you know, systematic racism and everything. Let's empower the individual with information that will allow them to be successful. And so the diversion is to throw all this other stuff at young kids, and they don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. What young kids should be doing is focusing on their schoolwork, focusing on their skills, and then the world will be open to them. And, you know, whatever racism is out there will be so much smaller a factor when they actually have, you know, the opportunity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's key. What they're doing is they're exploiting what you're talking about when you're talking about Black, white, and Asian students. You're talking about cultural differences. You're talking about whether the family stays intact. That's a big cultural difference. What the focus is. And, you know, the family that is intact is going to push their kids to work harder with that. And so by taking that away and making it a grievance and saying this is happening to you because of the color of your skin, I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, David, who got into that, as you point out, David Johnson, who was the whistleblower for Project Veritas, you know, he probably grew up looking at the, you know, we're not going to judge people by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And he found that that was what he experienced.
What was really clear, and in early versions of the book, we were thinking about calling it Killing Martin's Dream.
Oh,
because yeah. David really believed in Martin Luther King Jr.'s formulation that it's not the color of your skin, but the content of your character. And that was sort of the way he lived his life. And he said, this DEI stuff is really a destruction of Dr. King's message.
It is.
And he said, this will lead to societal collapse if we do this.
Yes, yes. Racism is racism. You know, it's just got a different group that you put in there that you're going to push in. And to, again, to sort everybody, you know, put everybody in little boxes and, you know, different categories, and then check the number of boxes that they've got and say, this is a good category, that's a bad category. And a lot of these things are immutable, things that you can't change, like the color of your skin. And I'm sure that as a homosexual, he looked at this and, you know, you go back 25, 30 years ago, what did we have? We had the don't ask, don't tell. I don't need to know about your private sexual life.
Yeah.
Why does that have to be front and center? And even more so, as he saw there at Hasbro, why are you pushing this to kids without their parents' knowledge? That's grooming. Yeah, that's one of the most reprehensible aspects of this.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, he said, you know, his parents got divorced, but he grew up in a family that was supportive of education. His mother was Jamaican, and you know, that has a little different cultural aspect to it. You know, close to his father, and you know, he just said, like, gee, I grew up in a really nice America.
Yeah.
And you know, it didn't discriminate against me. My best friend growing up was El Salvadoran. I'm black, you know. Mm-hmm. Who cares? You know, when he was in college, he worked with a bunch of blue collar guys, you know. And so, you know, the terrible thing is that, and what we profile in the book is the really terrible discrimination laws which were enacted in the South before the Civil Rights era. We're all about keeping people from mixing with each other. You know, one of the laws we came across was you can't play a game of checkers with a black man. Mm. And so you find yourself going, you know, what these people really fear is that we're going to mix with people who are different than us, and we're going to like each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's remarkable about the whole DEI thing is I find their philosophy is exactly the same as the racist, terrible people, you know, in the southern states, you know, after the Civil War. You know, the thing they're terrified about is we're going to interact with each other and we're going to like each other.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's always the tactic of tyrants. They want to control people by dividing each other, dividing us from other people, and to make us hate people of other groups. They want us to see everybody as part of a group, and then they're going to tell us which groups are good and which groups are bad. Tell us a little bit about, you know, it's kind of interesting. David was working for Project Veritas, and of course now there's been internal issues with Project Veritas. When was this? I don't recall exactly when this was, but I'm sure this was before there was internal problems at Project Veritas. Is there anything that you can tell us, because you've done books for Project Veritas, about any future projects? What is the status of Project Veritas right now?
Project Veritas, since they got rid of James O'Keefe, has had a really difficult time. I believe they're in the process of closing down. They've actually let a number of people go. James O'Keefe has found a new group, O'Keefe Media Group. And so he's continuing on his mission. And, you know, I was really very, very honored by the fact that, and, you know, all of that instability at Project Veritas came shortly after a big revelation about what Pfizer was doing from a Pfizer whistleblower. So I'll leave that to people's imagination as to what was really going on there. You know, the mission continues, and I'm working with another Project Veritas whistleblower. And so we'll see where it all shakes out. But, you know, we don't want to, you know, worry too much about the instability. Let's, keep our eye on these people who are doing stuff that affects all of us.
Well, that's good. I just wanted to, the reason I asked about it was because I hope they do carry on, because they've done great work in the past. And it's, you know, and you've been a part of that work in terms of turning this research into several different books. Getting back to the book, and again, the book is The Diversity Con, Kent Heckenlively, and talking about the experiences of David Johnson, a packaging engineer at Hasbro, who became a whistleblower for Project Veritas. Talk to us a little bit about, as you look at the organizations behind all this DEI or DIE, whichever you want to call it, talk a little bit about the Tides Foundation and what you found out about the Tides Foundation in terms of your research.
So what's really interesting is, you know, if you're familiar with the nonprofit world, you understand most nonprofits exist on a shoestring budget, okay? Mm-hmm. But what we discovered through our deep research is that probably most of this instability is coming from a group called the Tides Foundation out of San Francisco, which in 2020 had a budget of $511 million.
Wow.
Okay. And they'd actually given out, I think, about $630 million in grants that year. And so the way this works is that rich people like the Gates Foundation, Soros Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, they'll give money to the Tides Foundation, and you can park your money there for a little while. They'll put it into funds. And then what you do is you tell the Tides Foundation, hey, why don't you give some money to this group? And they'll go and do it. And then the money comes from the Tides Foundation rather than, you know, the Gates Foundation or the Soros Foundation or Rockefeller. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Tides Foundation gets to be like Great Britain in my Pirates example. You know, oh, we give this money to this group and we listen to what they say. Oh, this group seems like it's going to be crazy. And, you know, the Tides Foundation has a little bit of deniability from it. So, you know, it's like they're hiring the subcontractors to cause problems. And, you know, we go through the financial records. I mean, it may not be sexy and everything, but I think it's important for people to know how this is being funded and who is funding it. And you know, from where I stand, a group like the Tides Foundation should be thoroughly investigated by government agencies to see how it's sowing discord in our communities. And I, like I said, I think these social justice organizations who are benefiting from this need to take a hard look at who's funding them and really whether they have the interests of minorities at heart, because I don't think they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it is interesting because you see these, I'll see some kind of initiative that's being put out there and I'll see some organizations like, I've never seen that before. And you start tracking it back and you'll find, well, they got money from this, or who funds that org? You keep tracking this back and you always find the usual suspects. It's like network of Moriarty that is out there. It usually goes back to one or two of these things. And usually the Tides Foundation is at the center of one of these things. But they just have layer after layer after layer. And, you know, most people don't go back and, oh, well, this is an initiative. Oh, that's a new group that's out there. And they don't realize, no, it's always the same people that are pushing this stuff through. Again, as you point out, you know, they're looking to get a monopoly on everything, to make sure that they're the stakeholders that have a stake in everything, and we own nothing, and they're going to make that that perfectly clear. Talk a little bit about the mechanism of how they get into the schools. Is that something that is, you know, of course, there's a lot of money that is coming out of Washington with the Department of Education, you know, taking the role of the Tides Foundation or something. But the Tide Foundation and these other organizations are involved in that as well, right?
What we believe is that the model that they're using is the Chinese Cultural Revolution. Mm-hmm. We think that they look at that as a really successful campaign. So what did the Cultural Revolution do? Well, they radicalized middle school students, high school students, and college students, okay? You know, I love my young people, but let's be honest. They're the dumbest people in society, okay? Because they're the youngest, okay? Hey, look, I was young and dumb, okay? I got older, I got smarter, okay?
That's right.
So that's what you need to do, because they will be radical. So you know, what they did in the Culture Revolution was convince young children to, you know, report on their parents. And think about how that destroys social bonds.
Yes.
So that's part of the strategy. You know, if you can capture the young, you know, who have more time, and you know, they're certain in their beliefs, you know, as I get older, I'm less and less certain in my beliefs, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, I was more certain of things when I was 20 than I am now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And you know, when you look at this, the authoritarians, the communists, the Marxists, whatever, they're always looking for useful idiots. I've said many times, there's no idiot that is more useful than a youthful idiot, because they don't have the experience. They don't even have the same capability of making judgments. And of course, this is part of what everybody is concerned about when we look at the grooming and the gender manipulation that is happening with all that. And that is a big part of it as well. Just to keep these kids in a constant state of confusion, to drive a wedge between them and their parents, but to, again, to just disruption. That is a key thing, and everything they're doing is disruption from the inside, and to do it iteratively. It truly is amazing to see that this is continuing on. And do you have some... besides looking at the background, what would your recommendations be? I don't know if they're in the book, The Diversity Con. Maybe you're just laying out the foundation, or do you make any recommendations after you expose what this con is all about?
Well, think of this anti-human agenda they're pushing. So the anti-human agenda they're pushing is to drive us into smaller and smaller groups. Mm-hmm. So if you want to fight this, what you should do is have a wide circle of friends.
I agree.
Talk about ideas. Let people understand that, you know, you are interested in solutions. And I think that's something that, you know, for those of us of a more conservative bent, I think one of the problems, the mistakes that we make is we get too worked up about all the evil. And in our presentations, we come across as mad and angry. And what we should be is joyful, because what we're doing is we're pushing the positive parts of the human experience. I mean, I have lots of friends who look very different than me. Look, mm-hmm. you know, I just recently turned 60 years old. Okay, I'm an old white guy. My co-author is a 26-year-old black guy who's gay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I adore this guy. He is going to be a force in the future.
Mm-hmm.
By my interactions with people who are different than me, it enriches my life to an extent that I just, you know, it's difficult to describe. So we conservatives should be filled with love. We should be filled with hope. We should be pushing the success of every human being. And if we can show that, when we come up against these hateful people, it will be so clear to everybody else that we are the good guys.
I agree.
And they're the guys who are deluded. They're working under misapprehension. Because I believe a lot of these people in these organizations, they believe the lies. We can't hate them because they believe the lies. We need to gently show them that they're wrong.
I agree. Yeah, I think that, you know, you can't win a culture war if you don't have a culture, as many people say. Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't fight against just saying not that, and you don't have anything to offer anybody. I think it's one of the reasons why they were so adamant about shutting down churches. They, you know, oh, you can open up the casino, but don't open up a church during COVID, right? They don't want to have people coming in as they are. They don't want to have a community. And I think it is always, we focus so much. I talked to the guy who has the Tuttle Twin books, and he's got a think tank that he works with for state politics, Libertas. And he was pointing out, he said, you know, we focus so much in politics on the area that we have the least control over, you know, the federal government or the presidency or something like that. We don't focus on our state or on our community. We have a lot of power in that area. I remember you and I are not that much different in age. I remember Tip O'Neill, he used to say all politics mm-hmm. is local. They understand that all politics yeah. is local. And we have so much power to make things happen in our physical relationships, one-on-one with each other, in a community, in a church, all these other things. And that's why they want to keep us isolated, as you pointed out. That is their ultimate goal, is to keep us atomized and isolated. And I also have experience as a libertarian. And you know, we have to understand, I remember G. Edward Griffin said, we have to act collectively for individual liberty. And that's a difficult thing for a lot of people who are hyper-individual in their perspective, to think yeah. about how we have to work collectively in a community, making friends, getting to know people, not necessarily, you know, only exclusively online, but one-to-one. We have to do that, and we have to work collectively for individual liberty. I agree with you. You're absolutely right. I think that really is the way that we undercut this thing. We can undercut them at the grassroots level, because we certainly don't have any power in Washington. They buy all the politicians. There's unlimited amounts of money to buy politicians. They're the best investment anybody could ever make. So we can yeah. cut that down at the grassroots level. I absolutely agree with you about that.
So the book is The Diversity Con, and yes. I'm sorry, David, but I got to be rushing off.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's good. So, it's been a great discussion. The Diversity Con, and again, Kent Heckenlively, The Diversity Con, an excellent book, I'm sure, that's going to be very useful for a lot of people. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it, Kent.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Thank you. Have a good day. Folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back. We'll talk a little bit about Disney, for example. I've got some information about them. We'll be right back.
Listening to The David Knight Show.